until 1972, subsequently a lecturer and then reader in modern history at the University of St. Andrews. This year, he is visiting the UBC Department of History as a visiting professor. He has been the author of many articles and a number of books. Two of these, Spain and the Netherlands, 1559 to 1659, Europe in Crisis, 1598 to 1648, have been published in paperback during the past year. Do my Johnny Carson thing. They look like that. And I believe they're available currently in this city. His current research is involved on the rise, with the rise of European influence in the world since between the Crusades and the Seven Years' War. He is well known as a lecturer in Britain and in continental Europe, and we're very happy to have him here tonight to address us on conscience and power, Philip II of Spain in history and in legend, Professor Geoffrey Parker.
Thank you. Have your notes back. I write of the great events of an unquiet century, with the beginning of a chronicle, a contemporary chronicle, of Spain's most famous monarch, Philip II, who dwelled right at the centre of those great and complex events of the later 16th century, making his long life exhausting to live, elusive to write about, and confusing to study. He ruled one-fifth of the land of Western Europe and one-quarter of its population. His dominions around the globe, from the Philippines and Peru to Spain and Sicily, dwarfed those of the Roman Empire at its apogee. Under his scepter lay the bustling cities of Antwerp, Madrid, Seville, Mexico, and subjects as diverse as the great anatomist Andreas Vesalius and the saint and mystic Teresa of Avila. And the king's scepter was charged with supreme power. King Philip, observed one of his courtiers, was like Christ because he could make men out of clay. And what he made, he could also destroy. William the Silent, Prince of Orange and founder of the Dutch Republic, was not the only man who was assassinated in cold blood at Philip's behest. The king felt no guilt and no remorse at the deaths that happened at his command. Like other statesmen in other periods, he had been obliged to cultivate that impersonal political carapace that we today call raison d'etat, the belief that the good of the state overrides morality, conscience, and even common sense. The ethical problems of conscience and power were, of course, not new in the 16th century. They'd been discussed by Greek playwrights and philosophers more than 2,500 years before. We're still waiting today for an acceptable synthesis on the problem of conscience and power. Only last month, or rather 2 months ago, Anthony Blunt, a professor of art history and a lover of beauty, was found to have betrayed his country and his culture to further the power of a Philistine and anti-intellectual autocracy. And the best justification that he could find was the same defense advanced by Antigone against Creon in ancient Thebes. He said, "This was a case of political conscience against loyalty. I chose conscience." A little longer ago, in 1967, a German playwright, Rolf Hochhuth, published a play called Soldaten, Soldiers, about the moral issues that confronted Winston Churchill during 1943 as a result, on the one hand, of the strategic bombing of Germany, and on the other by the discovery that his Russian allies had massacred large numbers of Polish officers at Katyn. The impact of the play is unfortunately muted because the author took over the badly researched and highly implausible theories of Mr. David Irving, who suggested that Churchill connived at a conspiracy designed to assassinate the Polish leader General Sikorsky. But despite this blemish, Soldaten offers some telling insights into the modern, the contemporary problems of conscience and power. "What, General Sikorsky, do you want?" Churchill asks in Act One of the play. "Do you want to write history? Then seek the truth. Or do you want to make history? Because then it's the circumstances that matter, not the truth." and in 1943 the circumstances decreed that the Poles should not make any fuss about their dead comrades at Katyn, since it might upset Britain's wartime alliance with Russia. And similarly, in Act III, Churchill informs his spiritual adviser, "To govern, my dear bishop, one must treat truth as the mariner treats the pole star. Never let it out of your sight, but don't always head straight for it. Men may be bound by friendship. Nations are only bound by self-interest." But these modern examples seem to me to offer no lead, no way out of the dilemma posed originally by the Greek philosophers. Soldaten, although it's interesting and provocative, is a work of imagination, not of history. The history of Anthony Blunt, although doubtless also partly a work of imagination, is insignificant and tedious. If I've chosen to base my analysis tonight on Philip II of Spain, who lived 400 years ago, it's because the major decisions that he took were important in the sense that they affected millions of people, and because his reasons for those decisions are extremely well documented. Although Philip left neither a personal political testament like his father Charles V, nor an autobiographical apology like his brother-in-law Henry III of France, he left literally tons of paper covered with an almost illegible spidery scrawl which recall his problems, his doubts, his joys, and his sorrows. The royal portrait which I shall draw for you will surprise those of you who've been reared on John Lothrop Motley, whose Rise of the Dutch Republic depicted Philip as a perfidious hypocrite in private and an obtuse autocrat in public. "The common enemy of Christendom," said Motley, "a man whose malignity and duplicity were almost superhuman, a man who lacked a single virtue, a man who was prevented from possessing every vice only because no human can obtain perfection, even in evil." This extravagant, impassioned portrait will just not do. The 16th century had a way with tyrants, obtuse or not. Henry III and Henry IV of France discovered that to their cost they were both assassinated. In the case of Henry IV, in 1610 he succumbed to his 20th would-be assassin. Yet Philip II was never the target for an assassin. And yet he lived all his life in public. He walked and rode among his subjects alone and unarmed, whether it was alone in the fields or in crowded streets. The king relished his informal, easy, personal contact with his subjects. Every day he paused on his way from hearing mass to listen to any complaints or petitions presented to him by people who had come to see him. As he travelled around his kingdoms on progress, he would share a cup of water with an old lady by the side of the road. He would accept and eat some cod offered by local fishermen. He would go with his children to public lectures when he visited a university town. Everywhere, all among his people, open for anyone who wished to kill him. But nobody did. He dressed simply, usually in black. Although he was fastidious about personal cleanliness, having a new suit of clothes made for him every month, the design and the colour of those suits was almost always the same. He looked, according to several observers, just like a well-to-do gentleman or an ordinary citizen. That's how he appears in probably the best known of his portraits. Let's see if I can black you all out. Which was done in 1579 by the official artist Sanchez Coelho, when the king was at the height of his powers. There's very little in that portrait to suggest that here you are dealing with the most powerful monarch of his day. There's nothing in that portrait to suggest he's a king at all. And that's a mistake you wouldn't make looking at any portrait of Queen Elizabeth of England, who never left these things to doubt. But perhaps that desire to blend into the rest of humanity, to avoid being identified as the man with supreme power and supreme responsibility, is just as revealing in its way as Queen Elizabeth's need for self-assertion. Philip's dislike of pomp and ostentation went far beyond sartorial simplicity. He created in the course of his reign a private world in which he could hide from the real world. The components of this secret refuge were gardens, hunting, fishing, books, collecting. And the king took personal control, personal charge of all the aspects. He even laid out and designed his own gardens. Here's a drawing that he made himself with his appalling writing underneath it, which shows how he wanted a garden at a new palace laid out. He wanted it in squares with two fountains. The two, I wonder if this little thing will work. Yes, there they are. There's the two fountains in the middle and a column at the end, a column of pillars. So he laid it all out himself. He chose flowers himself so that every bed in every garden would have something in bloom all the year round. He planted trees in profusion, 223,000 trees planted at Aranjuez, one of his favourite palaces south of Madrid, where they gave shade to magnificent gardens created by a system of irrigation specially made by Dutch engineers brought in from Holland at the king's expense. Philip lavished even more attention on his palaces. The Palace of the Escorial, the most famous of all, built between 1564 and 1583 at a cost of 7 million ducats, more than Queen Elizabeth had in revenue the whole of her reign, which was 35 years. It's just the largest and the most famous of Philip's constructions. He lived a lot of his life in the middle of a building site. He chose the sites. Sometimes he even made the designs himself. Here's a perfectly neat design coming from one of his architects, and you'll see that right at the top, the king has added another story on. Those untidy lines at the top, not in keeping at all with neat underneath, were made by Philip himself. He saw his architects twice a week to make sure that the Philip II style with its black slates and its red brick was followed. And because he didn't trust his architects, he regularly visited the work in progress just to make sure that everything he said was to be carried out. The king was also a devoted hunter. This is a slide of the Pardo Palace where the late General Franco died. It remained a palace of the state right through to the end of the Franco years. And there it is, you see a heart poised, waiting for an arrow to sink in its quivering buttocks, waiting for Philip II to go and shoot it. Philip II was an avid hunter. At the age of 10, his father had to limit the number of beasts that the enthusiastic prince could shoot each week because the resources of his game park were becoming depleted. Even at the age of 70, he was trundled out in his coach to sit in the middle of a forest while beaters drove in the game, and he shot at it with a crossbow. When he wasn't hunting, the king liked to fish. And the royal fish, the royal carp, in the royal pools were therefore protected from poachers by draconian legislation. Anyone caught fishing, even for the first time, got 100 lashes. The king didn't intend to spend his days fishing and catch nothing. Before he went to the Pardo in February 1566, he issued the following order. The water level in the small lake should be allowed to fall overnight, so that it will already be lower tomorrow, and I can fish there if I want. So the fish could expect no mercy. The water would be down, and they'd all be panting for the king's hook to grab them. Philip II was also a keen collector, and the range of his intellectual curiosity is impressive. The Great Library at the Escorial is just one example, 14,000 volumes, all from his own private collection. He possessed maps. He had enough suits of armor to equip three companies. There they all are. They're still in the Royal Palace at Madrid. He had jewels, statues, and other treasures. His household was supplied with over 200 musical instruments, ranging from a glockenspiel, which he had brought from the Netherlands and mounted in one of the towers at the Escorial, to 16 bagpipes. What he used them for, I haven't yet ascertained. Perhaps a small bagpipe ensemble. His palaces were decorated with over 700 paintings, including paintings which today are absolutely priceless. For example, this famous one by Hieronymus Bosch, part of the Garden of Worldly Delights. Philip II not only bought the original, he had a tapestry woven so that he could have one in two palaces and could see it all the time. He also had a number of pictures by Bruegel, the blind leading the blind, and a large collection of pictures by Titian. Most of them, in fact, what we would today call soft porn. You notice that there is a man playing the organ with his right hand, his left hand carefully concealed, as he has a good look at Venus. And if you think that's an aberration, and here's another one, this time the man is playing a lute with one hand and looking at Venus. Philip II had eight of them. He had a whole series called The Poesy, deceivingly enough, but I think we would call it soft porn. He had 137 clocks, large numbers of astrolabe. That's Philip II's own clock, which he had on his desk so that he could see what time, how time was going away, time always running away from him. His motto was, Io con il tempo, time and I are a match for anybody. Had 137 clocks, numerous astrolabes for the navigation he never undertook himself, 5,000 coins and medal, and so on and so on. Philip's entire personal collection was valued at 7 million ducats when he died. And if you want to imagine that in current terms, go to the Escorial, look at it, and think how much it would cost to build and to furnish it. And that's the value of Philip II's personal treasure. Not only the palaces, but enough of a collection to finance another one as big as that. The king patronized artists, scientists, explorers, and even historians. He established an observatory and a chemical laboratory at the Escorial, the Philosopher's Tower, in which tinctures and distillations and perfumes were made so that the king could have the smells of the flowers even when there were no flowers in bloom. Surely Philip II was one of the most cultivated men of his day. But whatever one's view of the king's aesthetic taste, there can be no doubt about his diligence in the exhausting craft of kingship. This is the king the year before he died, 1597, a tired, ravaged countenance, a man who has spent all his life looking at papers, slaving in the public service. On most days, he seems to have got up about 8 o'clock in the morning, I beg your pardon, woken up at 8 o'clock in the morning, and then spent an hour or so reading documents and minutes and memoranda in bed. He rose about 9:30 and was shaved by his barbers. He didn't need very much shaving, as you can see, and was dressed by his gentlemen of the bedchamber. Then he went to mass and gave audiences until noon, and then he had lunch. Then he had a little sleep, and after that became the main work of the day, which would keep him at his desk until 9 o'clock, when he had dinner. After dinner, which he always ate alone, never with his wife or family, he ate alone, he worked alone, and he went back to work alone until he was too tired to do any more. He dealt with up to 400 papers a day, reading them all, saw secretaries, ambassadors, architects, and messengers. Just to give you an idea of what a Philip II piece of work looks like, you see at the top right, a secretary has written in a fairly neat hand. Those of you at the back, I'm afraid, will be a little bit vague, but I won't leave it on the screen very long. That's Cardinal Granvelle, for those of you who like this sort of thing. As Granvelle's neat writing in the right-hand side, and Philip II scrawled all the rest round, giving his decision. That was what was to be done. I've seen the information, here is the decision. And he did that for 400 different decisions, perhaps a day, great and small, major and minor. He listened to reports, he took decisions. And although the tiny study at the Escorial in which he worked is quite famous, Philip II, in fact, would work at all times and in all places. And he even created a special archive in which all his papers were to be stored. There it is, the archive of Simancas near to Valladolid in northern Spain. There's the towers of the archive which Philip II used for the first time as a proper governmental archive. It's the first archive in Europe. All later ones are really modelled on it. Now, I'll give you some lights again. The king seldom went anywhere without work. On fine days, he would take his papers with him into the country. He regularly read state documents as he travelled in his coach from one place to another, and he would even transact business when he was on board a boat. When the royal family went sailing on the Tagus, the River Tagus at Aranjuez in 1580, Philip took a small desk with him and dealt with and signed dispatches which his valets brought to him. Meanwhile, court ladies danced on the banks and a Negro band strummed guitars. But there were not many working days that were as pleasant as that. More often, the king was complaining about the pressure of work, about eye strain, about overtiredness. I quote from a letter he wrote to one of his secretaries in 1575. I've just been given this other packet of papers from you, but I've neither the time nor the energy to look at it, so I won't open it until tomorrow. It's already past 10 o'clock and I haven't had my dinner yet. My table's full of papers for tomorrow because I just can't cope with anything more today. Or 2 years later in 1577. It's already 10 o'clock and I'm going to pieces and dying of hunger because it's a fast day and I can't eat any meat. These papers will have to wait until tomorrow. And sometimes he seems to have felt so oppressed by the amount of business that weighed upon him that he really wanted to give it all up and abdicate. I'm so exhausted and pained by what happens in this world, he said in 1568, that if it were not for things that cannot be abandoned, I really don't know what I would do. Certainly I'm no good for the world of today. I know very well that I should be in some other station in life, one not as exalted as the one God has given me, which for me alone is terrible. Despondency continued well into the 1570s. In 1575, we find him telling one of his secretaries that the position I hold is a foul one, and if you saw the problems I have these days, really, I don't know how I survive. And it's at times of this sort of mental and physical stress that Philip turned to try and find consolation with his family. First of all, he tried to find consolation with his wives, but they died on him before long. Let's black you out again, I'll give you another slide. Aha. There we are. There's Philip in the centre. There he is. And there's his wives all around him, four of them. Not all simultaneous. I mean, he had them consecutively. And later, after his wives died, he had his two daughters, who were really rather lovely. There's the first one, Isabella. And there's the younger one, Catalina Michaela, who really is, I think, rather charming. Philip thought so anyway. But despite insinuations to the contrary about Philip II being a lecher, incestuous, insatiably attracted to women, as far as we can see, historically speaking, he was no ladies' man. Indeed, we know that when he was obliged to perform his conjugal duties, he came out in a nervous rash. And we also know that he slept with his various wives as little as he possibly could. He would creep along to their rooms late at night when he'd been working, when he was hopeful that they would be asleep, peeped in, found they were snoring away on their bed, crept out again, having tried to do his duty but being unfortunately prevented, which is just what he wanted. The king much preferred slapstick to sex, and he retained a veritable cabaret of jesters. Here's one of them, Perichon, called a fool. Those of you who know King Lear will remember the fool in King Lear. Well, this is Philip II's fool, called Perichon, who has his hand on a rather interesting gadget. His left hand is clutching a rather interesting gadget, and his right hand is clutching a playing card. Mentally retarded dwarves were also very much in favour at Philip II's court. Indeed, he had 20 of them, supplied specially by the lunatic asylum in Saragossa. The most famous of these mentally retarded dwarves was called Magdalena Ruiz. And here is a picture of her with the king's daughter, Isabella. Now, it's obvious that Isabella is rather taller, although only 18, than Magdalena Ruiz, who is about 50. But she is a dwarf, and she was a great favorite. She entered the royal household in 1568, and she died at the Escorial in 1606. Magdalena had epileptic seizures from time to time and was heavily addicted to alcohol. She would stage tantrums in front of the king. Magdalena is very cross with me today, Philip told his daughters on one occasion. She's gone off saying that she wants to leave. She's a favorite with the crowds, who, whenever she appears, chant, whip her, in the hope of provoking an epileptic seizure. And she could always be relied upon to do the wrong thing, to fall over, to overeat and be sick, especially strawberries, to be seasick before anybody else. But that was just part of her charm. The king filled pages of his letters to his children, describing her deeds and defects. Sometimes he tells them with a slight smirk, as you might narrate the antics of a dog. But ordinarily, he describes her with affection and sympathy. The letters in which the descriptions of Magdalena appear were written by the king when he was in Portugal in 1581 and 1582. It's significant that he took Magdalena with him on this trip to Portugal. He couldn't really do without the sort of humour that she provided. And the letters which he wrote to his daughters, who were left behind while Magdalena came with the king, were perhaps the best known source on what we might call the private life of Philip II. There are about 100 of them, and they reveal a king who is a tender but rather forgetful father, solicitous for his children, humorous, a lover of nature, self-deprecating, a good eye for local colour. The letters, which have all been published, help to explain why it is that Philip excited such loyalty among his entourage, that one of them, Fray José de Sigüenza, was to write in 1606, at the end of his long description of the king's death 8 years before. All of us who were present shed a great number of tears at his passing, but they were few in comparison with our loss. And many have not yet dried their eyes, nor will they cease to weep until their life ends. Those lines were written by a monk, one of the many monks among whom Philip II chose to end his life. There was nothing particularly surprising that the king immured himself in a mausoleum, monastery, and a palace combined that's called the Escorial, because his father had also immured himself in a mausoleum, monastery, and palace combined at a place called Yuste. The plan of the Escorial was indeed based upon Yuste, Charles V's retreat, but the spirit of the endeavour was very different. It's true that in the last weeks of his life, Charles V, Philip's father, ordered and attended a requiem for his own soul. It's also true that he later fell into a trance while gazing at a Titian picture of the Last Judgment, but such macabre devotions and deathbed asceticism only came after the emperor had received unmistakable intimations of mortality. The rest of Charles's monastic career was spent pottering about like the pampered patient of an exclusive convalescent home, feasting on anchovies, overeating on melons, with the result, according to his chaplain, that his belches were louder than his voice, playing with his clock collection and fishing from his bedroom window into the well-stocked pond beneath. He rarely joined the monks at their devotions. His son was often to do just that at the Escorial. Now, there's more to this contrast between father and son than meets the eye. Philip always endeavoured to imitate his father, but he normally felt uncomfortable in doing so. And it could hardly have been otherwise. Charles V set no ordinary paternal standards for his son to live up to. An apparently decisive man of action, the victor of numerous battles, an instinctive leader and cosmopolitan traveller fluent in 5 languages, a master of the adroit phrase and gesture, equally at ease in the harsh glare of public ceremonies or the unbuttoned company of his intimates. And yet, this heroic ruler had only one son, one legitimate heir, Philip II, who was to succeed to and govern the vast empire he had created. And the 30 years of careful education which the young man received in the art of government only served to heighten his awareness of the need for success and the disgrace of failure. So Philip was saddled in the traditional Freudian way with a crushing psychological burden of self-expectation and a daunting compulsion to prove himself worthy of his father and his mission. And not surprisingly, as Freud could have told you, he came to harbour a deep insecurity about his capacity to play the public role expected of him by society, by his family, and by himself. Now, it's easier to detect this strange psychological scar in his private dealings than in the public dealings which might involve ministers and secretaries and others. Let me give you one example from 1566. At the age of 39 in 1566, Philip became the proud father for only the second time. He very much wanted to carry the baby to the font for baptism in person, but somehow he became obsessed that there was going to be some ridiculous mistake on his part which would make everybody laugh. So first he spent an entire afternoon retracing his route into the chapel over and over again, carrying a doll of the right size and the right weight, up and down for a whole afternoon. And yet even after all this rehearsal, nagging fears of some inadvertent clumsiness during the actual ceremony made him decide that he wouldn't have anything to do with it. And Philip ended up watching the service in which his child was carried by somebody else from a secret window in the chapel, sad, indecisive, and demoralized. And it was through his anxiety to live up to the only standards he knew and honored, to reconcile filial reverence with self-respect, that religion and conscience came into the life of Philip II. There can be no doubt concerning the king's personal piety. He kept a large library of religious books, and the jottings of his librarian show that the religious books were frequently consulted. He would, on an evening, call for a concordance of the Bible so that he could check up some point that had eluded him in his recollections of the scriptures. He had a selection of 41 books permanently by his bedside in a special bookcase. 40 of them were religious. He attended Mass every day, heard sermons at least once a week, confessed and received communion 4 times a year. He went on retreat regularly each Lent, and also at times of personal stress, for instance, just before imprisoning his chief minister in 1579, and again at the death of his 3rd and 4th wives. Attendance at divine pleasure was for him clearly a pleasure. The monks of the Escorial noticed that on occasion tears would roll down the king's cheeks when he was at prayer or in contemplation. On Christmas night 1566, the king sang the watch night offices with the monks in the half-finished choir of the great monastery, bareheaded, freezing, but elated. On Corpus Christi Day in June 1570, the king was again bareheaded, this time in a procession in the blazing heat of Cordoba in the south of Spain. He was warned about the risk of sunstroke, but replied, "Today the sun will do me no harm." Deeply religious people were quick to recognize Philip II's faith. In 1549, when the king was 22, Ignatius Loyola, founder of the Jesuit order, wrote of the breath of goodness and sanctity that emanated from the prince. 30 years later, Santa Teresa of Avila, Saint Teresa of Avila commented on the deep spiritual awareness of her king when she was granted an audience with him. Perhaps she detected the love of solitude which Teresa also had. You remember that Teresa's angelic spirits thrived on solitude, on being alone. So did Philip. And certainly Philip protected the saint against accusations of heterodoxy, and when she died, he made sure that all her writings and papers were secured for his library at the Escorial. It's largely thanks to the interest of Philip II that we know the writings of Saint Teresa. But Philip II's religion wasn't limited to his relations with God and the saints. He regarded himself and his kingdom as in some way the beneficiaries of a divine dispensation. He believed that his Spain had a special mission or destiny. The problem was to identify it. What was that mission? On the whole, Philip was content to wait until Providence would reveal itself. As with the extinction of the Portuguese royal family, against all predictions in 1580, every member of the royal family except him died out, and he was able to annex that neighbouring kingdom of Portugal with hardly a blow being struck. But where religion was concerned, the king sometimes tried to force the pace of Providence, to anticipate Providence. Against Elizabethan England, he launched invasions in 1571 and the more famous Armada in 1588. Against the revolt of the Netherlands, led by Calvinists, he fought ceaselessly for 25 years. In France, he undertook a major war for the last 10 years of his reign in order to prevent the triumph of the Protestant cause in that kingdom. When his subjects, assembled in Parliament during the 1590s, protested that the cost of so many military operations was ruining Spain, the king was unmoved. He rebuked them with the words, "These are not matters which can be abandoned. The religious issue takes priority over everything." And when the protests nevertheless continued, the king grew angry. "The deputies, the members of Parliament, should and must put their trust in me, in the love I have for these kingdoms, and in the long experience I have in governing them. They must accept that I shall always do what is in their best interests. Speak to them at length in this vein, and advise them that they are never, on any pretext, to come to me with such a suggestion again." This inflexible response to criticism, rooted in an almost pathological fear of being wrong, was always a feature of Philip II's government, but in the 1590s it became much worse. A hardening of the arteries seems to have set in, affecting the king's mind as well as his body. He was no longer moved by ordinary emotions, displaying to the world an almost reptilian composure in the face of joy and sorrow alike. Once his mind was made up, Philip was almost invincibly opposed to changing it. He became less objective in his evaluation of information which affected a decision already made. He would twist it to suit his purpose and to support his original plan. The classic example of this occurred with the invasions of England in 1571 and 1588. Philip claimed on both occasions that his grand design was of conquering the island of England was directly commanded by God, and he overrode all the practical objections to the invasion plan posed in turn by the Duke of Alva, the Duke of Medina Sidonia, the Duke of Parma, the men who were to carry out the invasion. "I am so keen to achieve the consummation of this enterprise," he wrote to Alva in 1571. "I am so attached to it in my heart, and I am so convinced that God our Saviour must embrace it as his own cause, that I cannot be dissuaded from putting it into operation." The invasion, in fact, never left the shores of Flanders. It was still born. In 1588, the commander of the Armada was subjected to the same sort of spiritual blackmail. When the Duke of Medina Sidonia tried to stay at Carana after a very bad storm, he was told by the king, "I have dedicated this enterprise to God. Get on then and do your part." The Duke of Parma was told that the absence of a deep water port in the Netherlands didn't really matter because God would provide one. And the Armada was sent, in the phrase of one of its senior officers, in the confident hope of a miracle. When the first rumours of a disaster arrived at the Spanish court in October 1588, Philip II just could not believe his ears. His oft-quoted Stoic sentiment, "I sent my ships to fight against men, not against the wind and the waves," was only uttered after he'd had a considerable time to absorb the impact of the defeat. His initial response, in a note to his secretary, which I had the good fortune to find, displayed utter incredulity. "I hope that God has not permitted so much evil," he exclaimed, "for everything has been done for his cause." Against blinkered intransigence on this scale, appeals to the rational calculation of Spain's best interest were unlikely to succeed. The cost to Spain of this harnessing of Philip II's conscience to the logic of imperial power was the loss of 70 ships, the death of 15,000 Spaniards, the financial ruin of the government, and the sacrifice of national prestige. Perhaps the king can be forgiven for thinking that his faith had let him down. He had followed his religion, he'd followed his conscience, and in Philip's mind they were one and the same thing. How could they be wrong? This brings us back to the general point with which I started, the eternal question of how conscience and power ought to be reconciled, ought to interact. It's worth stressing that Philip II is as a Christian ruler. One can divide perhaps all world religions, the great religions of the world, into two, those which are both missionary and messianic, such as Judaism, Islam, Christianity, and more recently communism, and those which are either missionary or messianic, but not both, such as Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism. Rulers professing one of the latter category of creeds, which tend to favour a policy of live and let live, rarely commit themselves to expensive imperialist crusades on ideological grounds. The Holy War is found almost exclusively among Jews, Christians, and Muslims, who believe that the world can be made truly safe for their faith only by exterminating all the others. This may not be deleterious in domestic affairs. On the contrary, a ruler's belief that he'll answer for his actions at the seat of judgment may encourage measures to promote the greater peace, prosperity, and discipline of his subjects. The danger and the damage comes when religion and conscience are applied to diplomacy. Christian politicians usually fail to distinguish the Christ of Matthew, chapter 21, who went into the temple of Jerusalem and drove out the money changers, from the Christ of Luke, chapter 9, who rebuked James and John for wanting to call down fire from heaven to burn that Samaritan village which refused to accept their teaching. For the Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. Christ would use force to set his own house in order, but not to use, he would not use it against outsiders. The failure to distinguish between these two Christs goes back to the very first Christian ruler, the Emperor Constantine the Great. In 312 AD, at the critical battle of the Milvian Bridge, the then pagan emperor happened to look up and saw a flaming cross engraved with the message, "In hoc signo vinces," with this sign, "You're gonna win." Well, it had to be in Latin because he was a Roman emperor, you see. Constantine accepted this useful offer of assistance and was duly victorious, offering a potent example to all subsequent Christian politicians, including in our own or very recent past, our own day or very recent past, General Franco and the Reverend Ian Paisley. The need the marriage of Christian values to statecraft always produce such ugly and malformed offspring as Paisley and Franco? Is it always true, as Lord Charwell is made to say in Hogarth's play Soldaten? When a man says that he's bringing conscience to his diplomacy, it only means he's hiding the fact that he's bringing diplomacy to his conscience. Alas, history teaches us that such is almost always the case. Even if Churchill did not connive at the murder of General Sikorsky, and I think only David Irwin believes that he did, he certainly prevented proper investigation of the Katyn massacres, and far worse, he sanctioned the forcible repatriation of over 2 million Russians and Ukrainians many of them incidentally held in Canada and repatriated from Canadian ports, despite clear evidence that they were all either shot on their return or sent to labor camps for terms of 10, 15, and 20 years. Conscience unequivocally dictated that these repatriations should be stopped. Diplomacy, however, required that the agreement made with Stalin at Yalta, which involved sending back all Soviet nationals, should be kept. Diplomacy won. Only a handful of the Russians and Ukrainians in Allied hands managed to remain in the West. But diplomacy won by foul means, not fair. There was virtually a conspiracy in the British Foreign Office to prevent and suppress all evidence concerning the reception accorded by Mother Russia to her returning citizens from becoming public knowledge. Even the Prime Minister may not have known. And the newspapers and the journalists were prohibited from reporting the harrowing scenes which normally accompanied embarkation. Many Russians tried or did commit suicide rather than be sent home. Others only got on board the ships because they could no longer resist the bayonets, the blows, and the guard dogs which Western soldiers turned on them in fulfillment of a policy endorsed by Churchill and Truman. Not for nothing has this episode been called the last secret. Had those details been made known to the public and discussed in Parliament, I think there's no doubt that that fatal policy could not have been pursued to its bitter end, just as Philip II would have been compelled by his Parliament to make peace in the 1590s, had his decisions been dependent on the consent of his subjects. The lessons implicit in these and many other examples are clear. First, diplomacy is just too important to leave to the diplomats. The objectives and the methods of every country's foreign policy must be constantly questioned and criticised if we are to ensure that crimes are not to be committed, whether it's by troops or by the intelligence agencies, for the sake of national interests which need no such defence. And second, we must seek to define those objectives and those national interests in terms which are as far as possible morally neutral, because morally neutral interests are much easier to criticise and to question. To a large extent, the international confrontation which we face today has been brought about because national interests have become subsumed into ideologies, whether it's a communist ideology or a liberal free world ideology. And these ideologies have been invested with a near metaphysical status, which makes simple criticism or even doubt seem almost to be a heresy which is rocking the boat of stability. Historians perceive easily enough the stupidity of these identifications in the past. Who now cares about the white rose or the red? Well, Yorkshiremen and Lancastrians apart. Who cares about Armagnacs and Burgundians, Jacobins and Girondins, even Bolsheviks and Mensheviks? But we still fail to separate today current overseas objectives from teleology. Even Marxist historians are just as bad as Christian historians used to be. They portray the past as a constant struggle of good and evil, simply that the efforts of workers against bourgeois capitalist running dogs have replaced the Homeric duels of Christians against Moors or Catholics against Protestants. The relationship between conscience and power is one of the many questions facing societies today, which has also confronted societies in the past. It therefore raises, finally, the question of how far historians are entitled to predict the future. I myself do not believe that the past can dictate to men what they should do or should believe. But I think that it certainly can show men what it may be imprudent to do. If there's a lesson in the story of Philip II to which you've listened so patiently tonight, it's surely this, that to lock national interests into the furtherance of a supranational ideology is an act of supreme folly. We should not be overhasty to condemn Philip II for sending his invincible armada in order to make the world safe for his beliefs, at a time when our own rulers seem resolved to launch a nuclear armada in order to make the world safe for their beliefs. There is, I hope, still time for us to learn from the past in general and from Philip II in particular. For as Ranke said, those who do not learn from the history are condemned to repeat it. Thank you very much.
Dr. Parker has agreed to answer questions for newcomers and visitors. The rules of the Institute are one question per person. Your question should be a question. It should be brief. Would you please speak it loud enough that we can hear it at the front? And I'll ask Professor Parker to repeat it before answering it so that those at the rear can hear too. Are there questions? One or two.
Thanks. The man who intervenes in a matrimonial dispute from the stage is indeed foolish, sir.
Dr. Parker, could you give any evidence from your talk or your background which would suggest that power cannot corrupt, especially when it becomes of a national interest? Conscience must inevitably be denied or replaced by expediency.
That's a very hard question. I obviously asked myself that before.
Did everyone hear the question?
Sorry, the question was, as I understand it, can I think of any examples where it was right to override conscience in the interests of national interest and power? Is that your question? I asked myself that before I started. And I'm afraid I was unable to come up with a single case where I felt it had been right to override the interests of basic human interests. I'd be interested if anyone in the audience, no reason why we shouldn't throw it open, can anyone else, there are one or two historians here I noticed, wanted to anyone in fact provide an instance where perhaps conscience was overridden rightly in the long run? Was that conscience, sir, do you think? Do you think it was conscience that dictated that he should not ally with the Russians, or do you think it was just his own past? After all, he had no first-hand knowledge of Russian society. The particular example of repatriating the Ukrainians, I think, is one example where his conscience should have told him better. I think in 1940, after all, Germany invaded Russia. What was Churchill to do? Just sit by and watch another power being overwhelmed, which almost happened? Or was he going to make an alliance which was not necessarily against his conscience? I can't see how conscience entered into that decision that early. Dr. Conway. Tell me more, Dr. Conway. Not my period.
Briefly, Dr. Conway.
Over what issue, for a start?
Over the issue of whether the British Labour Party should endorse the policies of peace and an outright pacifism, or whether, as Ernest Bevin said, they were sick and tired of having George Lansbury hawk his conscience around from one continent to another.
I think the key issue here is the question of pacifism. It is arguable that Christianity leads to pacifism as much as it leads to imperialism and crusade, and that one perfectly respectable response of the Christian in a world situation is pacifism, just to keep out. Now, that was an issue which a lot of members of the Labour Party in Britain in the well, right through from the 1900s, believed that their policy should be pacifism. I happen to believe that's wrong. I think that the Christian's role in all this is to exercise his conscience, as I was saying, constantly to check and to challenge and to question and to criticize policy in the interest of basic human decency and Christian standards. I don't believe the Christian should just keep out. I think the Christian should belong in society and should participate in society. But the pacifist objection is one which I find it very difficult on intellectual grounds to refute. Those who would stand up and say, well, I'm a pacifist and I think that's the right way for a Christian to behave. It's very difficult, in fact, to refute that view. Any more questions?
You may remember what Reinhold Niebuhr said at the time. He said, if democracy fails, it will be because well, there have been too many idealists with too many illusions, facing too many realists with too little conscience.
Before we get too far into the supplementaries, are there any other questions? One here.
Dropping of bombs on Hiroshima.
Fine, the question was, how would I evaluate conscience in the context of dropping atom bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima? Now, I'd like to answer that on two different levels, both of them, if you like, the question of national interest. It's a very good, I'm grateful to you for the question. I toyed with the idea of using this as an example, and in order to spare you a longer talk than you already got, I dropped it out. There were two reasons for dropping bombs, and the first one is generally known, and the second, I think, is not. The first reason was that the Japanese were not prepared to surrender and were therefore going to fight a prolonged land war in Southeast Asia, which the American army was quite well equipped to fight, but not so well that they were going to win quickly. VJ Day was thought to be 2 or 3 years away. So in 2 or 3 years, a lot of American troops are going to get killed, and that's the obvious answer for dropping the bomb. You compel the Japanese to surrender, and you save a lot of lives of the troops, Japanese as well as American, on the ground. Okay, that's one level. You can make your own judgment on that. But there is another. And the second one comes from a book called Night of the August Moon. I think that's the title, by Lawrence van der Post, who was a prisoner of war on Java. Now, the next stage in August 1945 of the Allied campaign was to take Java. And it had been decided by the Japanese High Command that as soon as the Allied troops landed on the island, all prisoners of war in the prisoner of war camps were going to be massacred. And there were something like 250,000 of them. Now, dropping the atom bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki prevented that as well. So not only do you save deaths of those who were on the front line and fighting, you also saved the lives of those who had been captured by the Japanese and who were undoubtedly going to be shot down. The documents were there, they were presented at the Tokyo War Crimes Trial, and no one argued that they were not genuine. So you had a situation where the Japanese were fighting and were in a way unwilling to accept that they were being beaten in a fair fight on the ground. And van der Post argued that one of the things that was an advantage about the atom bomb was that the Japanese could surrender without feeling that they'd in some ways been vanquished in the ordinary way. This was like the message from heaven, the flash of thunder which struck down the emperor at the moment of victory. They were able to see this as divine intervention, and this made it acceptable that in a way the atom bomb brought about a surrender in a way that ground fighting was never going to do. Not even bombing Tokyo, not even bombing all the towns of Japan would have forced a surrender of the conventional forces. It needed something that was almost supernatural, superhuman, to convince the Japanese that this was not an equal fight and it was perfectly decent and honorable to surrender. Although even then, of course, up to, I think, 5 years ago, Japanese soldiers were still surrendering in the jungle where they'd been holding out, believing that the Imperial Commission still required them to keep fighting to the end. So I think I'm not offering you a judgment on this because it's an issue which really is straight conscience against power. I can only speak for myself and say that I too, if I'd known all those facts, would have dropped bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and I would probably have been worried to my dying day about the rectitude of that decision. But given the information that we now seem to have, I think that that was correct, and that one should not condemn Truman for for doing something which seemed inhuman. If you had had all the data, if you had had all the American mothers, you remember the speech, all the American mothers who would have been weeping for their dead sons, you would have dropped that bomb too.
Mr. Parker, to get back to Spain and Philip, how did he deal with religious minorities in the country, namely the Muslims and Jews, or had Spain already been freed or cleared of these minorities?
There was something in Spain called the Holy Inquisition, or the Holy Office, and it was established in 1480. By about 1530, there are very few Jews coming before it. They've almost all been forced out of Spain. They're expelled in 1492. And those who stay behind are progressively screened by the Inquisition. One after another, they come up, they're tried, they're either executed if they're found to be Jewish in their religious practices, or else they're more or less forced to toe the line. By 1530, 1540, the Jewish problem in Spain is virtually non-existent. Spanish Jews are almost all abroad. It's a very interesting parallel between British homosexuals in the first half of the 19th century, of the first half of the 20th century. The legislation against homosexuals in Britain was so severe, so savage, that if you were homosexually inclined, you had to go abroad, which meant that almost all the Britons you met abroad were homosexuals. Hence the description of the British poof, you see. It was perfectly true. They were the only ones you ever met. And likewise in Spain, the slur that all Spaniards were in fact Jews or Muslims, because the legislation at home against Jews and Muslims was so atrocious that they had to emigrate, and they were the only Spaniards you found abroad in many parts, especially in Italy. There were a number of Moors who were called Moriscos because they, although of Moorish descent, they conformed or claimed to conform to Christianity. But in 1609, they too were expelled. Those who were Muslim by descent were driven out. So Philip II accelerates the process of unification of Spain, religious unification, religious homogeneity, by persecution through the Inquisition. And his son, Philip III, in 1609, completes the process by expelling those who are not able to be assimilated. So Spain becomes one of the few really unified societies in Mediterranean Europe. Elsewhere you have Jews, Muslims, etc. But in Mediterranean Europe there is one pure society, which is 17th century Spain. And they even make special statutes about it called limpieza de sangre, purity of blood statutes. No one can inherit an office, no one can have office, no one can be a member of the church unless he is absolutely pure Christian blood, no Moorish and no Morisco and no Jewish parents. So Spain really does go for its own minorities in a very savage and severe way.
I have three questions stacked, one, two, and three, I think, at the moment.
The question was, it's going back to Hiroshima. The question is, what would I feel had the American government dropped a bomb just to show what it could do? Yes? Right. Where would you think of dropping it? On a Pacific island with only a few savages there? It's very hard to find uninhabited areas on which you can safely drop an atomic bomb. The first bomb was dropped on a large city, and the Japanese did not surrender. It is argued that they were trying to surrender and negotiations were going on, but it later became clear that in fact a conspiracy of younger officers kidnapped the emperor to prevent the decision being made and being made public, the decision for surrender. And only when the second bomb was dropped did that conspiracy fall to the ground. So on those grounds, madam, I fear it's true to say that just dropping a bomb on an uninhabited atoll in the Pacific would not have been enough. If a bomb dropped on a large town like Hiroshima was not enough, then I think nothing less than that would have been enough either. Do you disagree, or? Okay.
I think I saw a hand up there a bit back. No? Sure.
Why the great power did not throw the the number one, the line of communication to concentration camps where civilian population was murdered. Authority with power which could do something and was asked to intervene but remained silent.
You're asking me why the British government did not do more to stop. Sorry.
America.
Okay, but why the Allied governments did not do more to bomb the areas around concentration camps so that the people inside could get out? Yeah. This is a very interesting question, and the only answer is, I think, well, this is a very dangerous answer, but it does seem to me that there's an element of anti-Semitism in both the British and the American governments during the 1940s, and that part of the reason why so little was done to help the concentration camp inmates was because, basically, there was a feeling that Jews ought to be in concentration camps. I'm sorry to say that, but if you look at the papers, if you look at the failure to do things, then the impression is very strong. And if you look even at the present day, why is it that only now a special commissioner has been appointed in the United States to deal with all the SS men and the Nazi refugees in America who've been sheltered for the past 35 years, so that only now is a process being begun into their careers and their doings? They have been sheltered. I think there's no one would dispute this. Why? What has been going on? Why are these men thought to be worth saving, if it isn't perhaps an element of anti-Semitism? The same thing, I think, with the Ukrainians and the Russians. Why were they being sent back? And in that case, I think the answer is an element of pro-communism in the British government. They could not believe that the Russians were going to treat their own prisoners of war in that way and have them shot and sent back. And even if they were, the desire to stay on good terms with the Russians, for I think pro-communist sympathies, overrode what might have been an issue of conscience. It's very, very heavily mined territories, madam. I was born during the war, so I didn't have to live through any of these terrible times. But there seemed to me important questions to be answered by American and British statesmen on precisely the lines that you say. Why was not more done to help the concentration camps first, and second, to liberate them? Because there was no speed at all to get to Buchenwald. On the contrary, the Allies stopped short before they got there. There was no rush to get in, although they knew who was there. The one attempt, I think, to bomb a concentration camp SS installation, in fact, ended in bombing the camp itself and killing a large number of the people who'd supplied information. Is that not true? I think it was Buchenwald, and I think they supplied a lot of information on Peenemünde and the rocket trials, and they asked for bombs to be dropped, and the bombs were misaimed and in fact dropped on the actual barracks where the prisoners were kept rather than on the barracks where the SS men were.
We have time for one more. I should say that this evening there is going to be coffee in the lobby and there'll be an opportunity to ask further questions of Dr. Parker. I'll take one from the back here.
If you're a friend of mankind, you don't want to eliminate large numbers of them by effectively napalming them, by burning them to death. The question that a statesman has to face is the lesser of two evils, and I argue that in this particular case, it is not a clear-cut decision that Einstein and Niels Bohr, who you recall was actually flown out of Denmark, specially to convince Roosevelt that you didn't need to drop a bomb. It seems to me that although those men had that particular opinion, they were not responsible for the thousands of American lives that would have been lost had ground fighting gone on. It seems to me that perhaps Einstein and Bohr underestimated the staying power of the Japanese army, which seems to me, even in retrospect, an utterly formidable fighting force. And when you look at the numbers and the achievement, These men were extremely, extremely well-trained and well-disciplined soldiers, and it was going to take an enormous amount of effort to dislodge them from the islands which they held. After all, MacArthur's brilliant offensive, Mountbatten's brilliant offensive, these were being fought in areas where the Japanese had not dug in as strongly as they were further north. The nearer you got to the Japanese heartland, the more ably defended those positions were going to be, so the casualties were going to be greater. And Bohr and Einstein and Heisenberg and the others were not in fact responsible for those American dead who would have been lost had the bomb not been dropped. But obviously, as a friend of mankind, as a decent human being, you have to protest that only the necessary amount of force should have been used. If you could show me that the second bomb was unjustified, then I would condemn it. If you can show me that the Japanese would have surrendered without either bomb, then I would say, yes, it was wrong to drop them. But the evidence seems to me to point the other way, that without both bombs, there would have been no surrender.
I'd like to call on John Norris, another historian in the middle distance, to thank our speaker. And if you're doing it from there, please do it very loudly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be asked to thank Dr. Parker, not only because he is a highly valued departmental colleague, last September one, also because he's one of the finest products of the Cambridge History School in the period, which since it's now over, we're able to recognize as having been one of the golden ages of that particular institution. Professor Parker tonight has given us a gorgeous Baroque portrait across an enormous canvas, not only of a great European, Philip II, but it's also included in it a sharp perceptive study of the great dilemma facing all rulers, facing Philip II particularly, the dilemma between conscience and reason of state. And he's presented, as we saw tonight, with an easy and entertaining sophistication that we might be tempted to describe as painless, or if not, with the contamination of painless and Parker in this particular area, which is not entirely happy. It remains, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, to ask you to join me in thanking Professor Parker in the customary fashion.
You're invited to stay for coffee in the lobby if you'd like to meet Professor Parker informally. You are invited to visit our membership desk if you haven't already done so. Next week, Professor Eli Mandel on A Poet's World, Readings and Comments.